Love this podcast? Support this show through the Acast Supporter feature. It's up to you how much you give and there's no regular commitment. Just hit the link in the show description to support now.
You're listening to Griefcast with me, Carrie Adloyd. How do we grieve for someone? How does it change and evolve as we get older? My dad died when I was 15, and it took me many, many years to be able to express what I had gone through. So I decided to create Griefcast, a chance to talk, share and laugh about the weirdness of grief and death. But with comedians, so it's not that depressing, I promise. Each time I talk to a different comedian about their own personal experience of grief, as we remember someone that they have lost along the way. Whether it was a long time ago or you've just joined the club, this is a chance to talk about the peculiar human process of death. Welcome to Griefcast.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot. We charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Mm. Hello Fresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.
Hey Griefsters, I hope you're having an okay week. The sun is shining today, which makes an improvement from the constant rain that we've had. I just want to say a huge thank you to everybody who took part in the Father's Day support group that we had on Twitter on Sunday. Everyone using the hashtag You Are Not Alone and hashtag DDC, and just everyone was so supportive and so wonderful, and it really did make the day ever so slightly easier to know that there was other people feeling like, oh God, because I don't know about you guys, but I thought this was one of the worst years ever. Social media was just absolutely full of it, and the emails I was getting. Yeah, so I think we can relax now that we've got Mother's Day and Father's Day out of the way. Obviously, we still have birthdays and anniversaries and everything else, and our grief, but hopefully we can have a brief rest from marketing emails. This week, I'm talking to presenter and writer Simon Thomas. Simon is a former Blue Peter presenter, as you were hearing us talk a lot about, and he's also a former presenter for Sky Sports. Simon came in to talk to me about his wife Gemma, who died in 2017 of blood cancer. Welcome to Griefcast. I'm here today with writer and presenter Simon Thomas. Hello.
Hello.
Simon, we recently did an event with Marie Curie,
yeah,
talking about grief, and I've heard your name, obviously, the grief grapevine. I'd heard your name, lots of people saying, oh, you should speak to Simon, he's really talking about it. And it wasn't until I met you, I hope this is bad, that I was like, he was on Blue Peter. Because everyone kept saying to me, he's Sky Sports.
Yeah.
I don't understand sport.
Don't worry.
Have a television.
Don't worry.
So even anything on Sky even is difficult for me to watch, even like the comedy stuff. And then when I saw it, I was like, I literally, like, you know, when you get transported, and I was like, I watched him when I was younger.
Oh, no, I don't want to know your age.
No, but it's probably, to be fair, I watched Blue Peter because I was quite old.
I really liked it,
yeah.
Well, I used to say 6 to 60.
Yeah, exactly, yeah, range. Yeah.
And beyond, I think.
And you just meant, so who was your gang?
My gang. So when I first joined, I joined in 1999. In fact, the weird thing is, the last place I worked before Blue Peter is just around the corner from where we are.
Oh, really?
Southerbridge Road. Worked for a charity called the Oasis Trust. I was trying to get on Blue Peter for years. And the third attempt, I got it.
And so I started off with Katie Hill,
Stuart Miles.
And Connie Huck, who was still there when I left. And then Stuart left, Katie left a year later.
See, this is embarrassing. You started in 1999.
Yeah.
So everyone knows my age because I'm always talking about when my dad died. So I was in my late teens and I was still watching movies.
I was six.
No.
I felt really old.
That's why, because definitely it was the end of my watching Blue Peas. But everybody knows, absolutely knows, my dad died in 1998. I was 15. So, yep, I fully remember you joining. But those were the days when there wasn't any other stuff to watch. So like...
There was, but nothing like the level now. When
no,
I was a kid,
that's
it was
like,
literally...
After school, you all watched Blue Peter.
Yeah, it wasn't quite black and white.
Yeah, yeah.
But it was very limited. Channel 4 wasn't around then.
Well, we had... I had Channel 4 by then. But like, after tea... Like, you'd watch Blue Peter, then Neighbours, then you'd get Fresh Prince, and you get, like, Simpsons. Like, that was... Those are the days.
And now when I look at Ethan, when he sits there and he gets up the Sky Planner.
Oh, my God.
It's unbelievable. I mean, sometimes it goes disc full.
Oh my God.
This machine can record an awful lot of television. Yeah, it goes disc full, and I go through it. 180 episodes of this cartoon. 200, because it's got it on series link.
Yeah,
and
yeah.
And it's playing out all day, and it records a lot, and it's...
It's terrifying,
a ridiculous
isn't
amount
it?
Of choice. And actually, I showed him Blue Peter for the first time probably 2 years ago.
Wow.
Got him and said, sit down. He turned around and said, is this happening now? I said, yeah, this is live. There is still such a thing as live kids TV, but there's not a lot of it.
No, yeah.
But it's vastly different now. And the competition for audiences is so different to when we were. We were still getting a few million. Now they're lucky if they get near a million. And that's no reflection on the programme.
It's just too much stuff. I loved Blue Peter.
So did I.
It was really, it was great. How long did you do Blue Peter for?
6 years.
Wow. Yeah, it's a big part of your life, isn't
Massive.
It? And then that's obviously how you became a full-time presenter, basically. Is that where...
Yeah, first break. I sort of benefited from someone else's misfortune. So twice I tried.
Yeah, yeah.
Twice didn't get anything beyond the usual keep your letter on file, which is code for no.
Yeah.
And then Richard Bacon gets dismissed in very...
Did you replace Bacon?
Did replace the Bacon.
Oh, my God.
Yeah.
Which, of course, I very vividly remember. Oh, my God.
Well, I remember standing in the office where I was working just near here.
Yeah.
On the Monday. So on the Sunday, it broke in the news of the
world. Yeah, oh, my God.
By the Monday evening,
he's gone.
And there's this really weird announcement from the then head of Children's BBC, Lorraine Heggessy. It was like some sort of royal announcement.
Oh, it was really
all in black,
formal.
Very
yeah.
somber. Really not. I didn't think it was a very good way of trying to relate a difficult subject to kids. I
think
they should have left
it
to the Blue Peas presenters, which they did to an extent. and I remember a woman who worked in this office just around the corner, and she'd had some experience of working in local news as a presenter. So, you know, I knew about the TV industry, and she just said to me, "You have to give it one last try."
Wow.
But she said, "Wait, don't go in there today. They'll be inundated. But this is going to be such a sensitive, raw time for them." Because Richard was very popular, and very good.
Yeah, I liked Richard. He was really great. He was really funny.
People were hurting that they lost him. They understood why.
Yeah.
Not really the time. The Monday after to go, "Hello, everybody. My show reel's on the way." But I remember there's a pillar box just near here, and I remember a week later putting my CV and the show reel into this little bag, senior address, TV centre, and put it in the post box just around the corner from here.
That's so mad.
And eventually got an interview, and then the audition, and then it was a really elongated process because they were so...
They must have been so nervous.
Oh, my days.
Have you ever gone out? Do you drink? Do you... Like, they must have been so, like, strict about your
lifestyle. Well, that was the last bit, because I had an audition, and this just wait of a week, and I could barely eat.
Because
I knew that this is the job I chased for ages. If I get it, it's a life changer.
Mm.
The stuff I'm going to get to do is going to be so beyond anything I've ever experienced. I hardly travelled at all before that I couldn't think about anything other than was
of
I going
course,
to get it.
Yeah,
and then eventually
get
dragged into TV centre. I say dragged. Asked to come in one afternoon. So I left here, got on the tube and was taken to Lorraine Heggessy's office. And there was the editor, Oliver McFarlane, the deputy editor, John
Cullifer,
and
Coke.
Lorraine.
And they were like, can you resist it?
But she did ask me that. There was like this little interview and she said, "Are there any skeletons in your cupboard?" And I said, "I did once, you know, have a few puffs on a joint when I worked at Selfridges in London after university. There could be a photo rattling around somewhere, but I didn't like it and I never touched it again."
Yeah, so...
And she said, "That's fine." Next thing, she leans into her fridge, pulls out a bottle of champagne and says, "You're Blue Peter presenter number 27.
Oh, wow.
And the most amazing thing was, Mark, going out of that room later on, there was this big board with the 26 presenters that they've ever been on the show. And you just thought, this is, without a shadow of doubt, the most exclusive club in the land. And I've just become a member. And then I couldn't tell anyone apart from my closest family for about a month.
Oh, my God.
To sit on it.
Yeah, because it was so, like you said, it was such a huge job then, wasn't it?
Yeah.
I know my mum used to always say to me, she says, you should be a Blue Peter.
Like, you'd have loved it because everything in it, acting, it.
Yeah.
Adventure,
she'd always
travel.
Say it, but I'd always be really confused. I was like, what, like, why? Why do you want me to do it? She's like, you're crafty. You like doing things. I was like, yeah. It just seemed like, for me, it always seems like those jobs on telly were like, yeah, but I don't. That's the telly people are doing those things. You know what I mean? Like the gap seemed like...
Untouchable.
Yeah, it was just
unreachable.
You know, you and Katie and, you know, Connie were like, well, they're just like magic people who live in the telly. They're not real people. Because you're a kid, you know, you've never seen them.
But that was the strength of the show, is that they went for unknowns. There were a few knowns down the years, but as our editor would always say when we looked for... You know, Katie's replacement ended up being Liz Barker, Stewart's ended up being Matt Baker. When those were auditioning, it was about, would I be able to take you round to one of our viewers' houses for tea? And the kids could just sit there and relax and chat to you.
Yes.
I mean, I obviously, clearly, I've revealed myself to be a bit of a Blue Peter fan. That's obviously not why you're here. But someone should do a Blue Peter podcast. That would be, I'd happily listen to that.
Can you imagine that?
Yeah, I'd listen to that. Oh, that's a good idea.
The cogs are turning.
Yeah. So, Simon, who are we remembering today?
We are remembering Gemma.
Gemma, who is, or
she was my
wife. Your wife.
Yeah,
your wife.
For 12 and a half years.
For 12 and a half years. Yeah. So when did Gemma die?
She died November 2017. So as we talk, it's sort of, we're not far off 18 months now, which sounds remarkable to me. This is, in some ways it feels an age ago, but then in other ways, the day she went, that whole week feels like yesterday. I can still... relive every single moment of it. Well, pretty much.
But that's still really recent in terms of grief, definitely. Like, that's very recent.
Yeah.
So how did you meet Gemma?
We actually, I'm sorry to keep coming back to Southern Bridge Road.
No, it's fine.
But Gemma ended up working at the Oasis Trust where I'd left to go to Blue Peter. She joined about a year later. She'd been at Sheffield University. Bizarrely, when she used to watch. So we got a lot of students watching Blue Peter because it's the time Neighbours is coming up.
Yeah.
You know, you've had your three lectures if you're an art student.
You're waiting
for the whole week.
Get pissed and go out.
Yeah. And you inevitably watch a programme like that, probably in truth waiting for Neighbours. But she actually said to her housemates one day, I think it was shortly after I joined, I'm going to meet him one day. Never more than that. She's not going to marry him, but I'm going to meet him. So she ends up doing that job. And then our boss, Ivor, had one of his sort of summer parties, late summer parties, a sort of champagne evening just near Windsor. And I'd actually gone there I was single at the time, to try and chat up another girl who worked at Oasis. Because I'd always thought she was a bit of a looker. And there's something about her that was a bit mysterious. Never quite got to know her. Anyway, I did end up having a bit of a chat. It went spectacularly wrong. The conversation died very quickly. And I was just sort of chatting to my mates and I see this girl I'd never seen before. And she's wearing this lovely cerise skirt and beautiful top, lovely blonde hair. And I thought, oh. And I got introduced to her and her name is Gemma. I mean, it's just one of those moments in life where you just connect with someone and you forget about time. I mean, I probably only talked to her about half an hour, but it felt like about 2 minutes.
Yeah.
And then at the end of the night, it was so embarrassing, but there was another girl from my old work who was there and she must have had the lion's share of the fizzy stuff because she was wobbling around the dance floor because we'd gone inside by this point. And she sort of tried to have a chat with me and then sort of pinned me up against the wall and was trying to give me a little goodnight kiss.
Yeah.
Gemma at this point walks back into the room wanting to say goodbye.
Oh no.
There I am in compromising position. I managed to shift her out of the way, got Gemma's number, broke the lad's protocol, which was no texts in the first 24 hours.
Wow.
I texted that night and said, love to see you again. And about a week later, we went on our first date and just sort of slowly fell in love with her. And, you know, when you talk about Blue Peter, she came onto the scene sort of about a third of the way through Blue Peter.
Right,
and then as I went onto Sky, she was the constant throughout that. We got married in 2005. And so, you know, for nearly all of my broadcasting career, because, you know, I've been honest about this elsewhere, it's such a weird industry and an amazing industry to be part of. It's a very vulnerable place to be.
Yeah.
Regardless of whether you've gone through something like this or not, it's because you have to do your job in front of people, whether that's like you do on stage, you're now in front of a microphone, you are doing something. You can't physically see them, but you are putting yourself out there for people to judge you, to make opinions on you. And I would often find myself quite paranoid in the social situations. I stupidly got it into my head that because I'm on Blue Peter, people expect you to be this larger-than-life character.
Yeah.
And you're going to regale them with tales of adventure and mishaps and
abseiling
all those kind of things.
And dogs.
Yeah, and dogs and annoying cats and a tortoise that never moves. And Gemma was my kind of, I guess in those sort of situations, my sort of shield. I felt so much more comfortable when I was with her in a social situation. And so she was for 90% of my life on TV, from BBC to Sky. She was the constant.
Yeah, that support. You really need that. I think it's hard. It's hard sometimes because it sounds like you're moaning about it. Like when I moan about like acting or comedy.
Yeah.
And you're not. You're just trying to explain how weird it is.
Yeah.
And, you know, one of my very, very good friends is a social worker, and, you know, like, obviously her job is far more meaningful than mine, but, like, she'll explain the weird, like, weird stuff. And it's, like, because our job looks exciting and glamorous, yeah. You're not allowed, like, any negativity sounds like moaning, whereas, like, even my friends moaning about working for the NHS and the complications, I'm not like, oh, my God, get over it. At least you're a social worker. Like, at least that's fun. But when you're a comedian or a presenter, people are like, oh, had a hard day, you know, wearing nice clothes and standing in front of the camera. But
doesn't that show you, once again, how futile comparisons are all the
yes,
time?
Yes, exactly.
Because
yeah.
I've had one or two messages on social media who say, you know, it's really bad what you've been through, but there's this person who's been through something worse.
Yeah.
And I go back to them and say, that is totally true.
Of course, there's always someone.
There's always someone, but that doesn't invalidate the pain I'm feeling.
Yeah.
And in the same way, when you're talking about your job, just because it's deemed to be an amazing job, and I was incredibly blessed and fortunate to do what I did, but that doesn't invalidate me when I do have those days.
And that's the thing, I think that if you don't say it, if you're not allowed to say it, if you go, oh, well, I shouldn't complain because I'm so lucky, you know, I don't want to upset these other people who are telling me I'm lucky. You just live with that emotion gets packed away, which is really bad for you.
Yeah.
So it's like, well, it might annoy you that I'm moaning about it, but I need to for my mental health.
Yeah.
I need to have a moan about it. So let's move forward ever so slightly. So how did Gemma die? What happened?
So it was all very, very rapid.
Yeah.
What took her life was acute myeloid leukemia and then a complication that happened because of the length of time she hadn't got any help.
Right.
So
okay.
She...
So you didn't know, that was the thing, you didn't know she had this.
No idea. So probably in sort of mid-October of 2017. And it was a tough period for both of us because I'd come off work with my second bout of depression, but this time with a really severe anxiety that led to panic attacks before games.
Oh. So this was before she was?
Yeah, I was in a really bad place.
Oh,
it was the first time I'd ever come off work due to mental health issues.
Yeah.
I'd never had panic attacks. And the last time I worked was at Old Trafford and had a full-blown panic attack 20 minutes before going on air.
Oh, that's so horrible.
The person, the voice that got me through that, she was in Norfolk at the time, was Gemma.
Oh.
And then I had to come off work because it literally became debilitating. And as that's happening, Gemma's starting to complain of these headaches. And it was becoming a kind of daily occurrence. And then as the days went on, it wasn't just a daily occurrence, but they weren't shifting.
Right.
And I don't think I see now, because hindsight is both a wonderful thing and a bloody horrible thing. I see it with much more clarity what was going on, but that's because
it's easy to see the timeline, isn't it? But when you're in it,
you can't
see the timeline at all.
And I don't think because of what I was going through, I was seeing things with the clarity I might have done had
you
I not
never
been.
Know.
But I'll never
know. You never know.
But I think what Gemma had, which, you know, I have talked about this before, but I think it's so true, particularly of women who are mums. There's that kind of will, that determination, that stubbornness to be there first and foremost for my family, to carry on. Like, she had terrible insomnia ever since we had Ethan. She had Ethan in 2009. I think the disruption that having a baby inevitably causes kind of stuck with her, and she had on and off battles with insomnia for quite a while. So she got very used to soldiering on even when she was feeling dreadful.
Yeah, and then when you're not sleeping as well, your base level's a bit fucked.
Yeah.
So, like, people go, how are you? Like, oh, I'm always awful. So, like, that's normal.
As ever,
that becomes
knackered.
Normal. Yeah, I'm always tired. I'm always knackered.
Yeah.
And so then you can't really differentiate between feeling really bad. She's like, well, I think I always sort of feel exhausted. That's kind of how I feel.
That's just me.
Yeah, it's really, that sleep stuff is really hard.
It's just like kind of a modus operandi for years.
Yeah,
in quite long periods.
God bless her.
And then it's sort of the fatigue accompanied by the headaches got progressively worse. So
and this is just over the couple of weeks, really, in October.
Yeah, so in mid-November, this has gone on for a while, I just say, look, I've got an appointment on Wednesday to get some more medication for the depression. I really think you should come in and I can talk to the doctor about what you're going through. So we sat down with our doctor and I had half joked a few times about him. He's a really lovely guy, but I always felt a little bit too quick to deliver the prescription, and not necessarily so good. And listen, I understand it. Doctors are under time pressures. Trying to get an appointment, as we all know, is a nightmare. But I did often say, jokingly, I'm worried that if ever either of us had anything serious, he'll never spot it. Anyway, so we had a chat about Gemma and the recurring headaches. And I think between the three of us, Gemma was really worried about me. She'd never seen me like this before. She'd never seen me having to come off work. And I was beginning to question my mind, could I ever go back to it? How do I get over this? How do I get over the nightmare of the last time I tried to work? And we kind of all agree that probably what was going on was this insomnia combined with a huge amount of stress towards me was triggering these headaches. But then by the Friday of that same week, she's gone downhill further. He's not in that day, so we see a different doctor. He examines everything in terms of her vital statistics, signs, and he says the words at the end. Now, this again is when I get angry with myself, but I go, ultimately, I can't change it, so stop getting angry with yourself. But he said to her, I'm satisfied there's nothing seriously wrong with you. She's dead a week later. Gone. And that weekend, she didn't get out of bed at all. And so we went back. Well, she went back to the doctors on the Monday. She refused to let me come with her because I had my counselling appointment. So even in what was turning into her darkest week, she was still putting me before her. I should have been in there with her. And as I found out from a doctor's chat with him in a few weeks later, I changed doctors, but I felt in terms of my healing from the anger I felt towards him, I didn't want to carry that with me the rest of my life. I've got enough to carry as it is without resentment.
Yeah.
And I sat down with him, and for some bizarre reason, she didn't reveal everything that happened that weekend. The fact she'd hardly moved from her bed, the fact that she was too exhausted to take her head off the pillow, the fact she'd hardly eaten. None of this was translated to him and said to him.
It's so hard because that's so common.
I know.
I remember when my mother-in-law was very sick and, you know, eventually died of cancer, and my husband would insist sometimes on going with her. And he would know that even the taxi journey to this doctor had been an absolute agony.
Yeah.
And they would say, the doctor would say, you know, how are you feeling? Oh, not too bad. And he'd be like, he'd be like, what? Like, when are we going to say the agony? Like, because it's that thing
I'm
of
feeling bloody horrendous,
yeah,
doctor.
Like, and it's the thing of if you are a coper or you're afraid to say, actually, I don't think I'm very well at all. And I know that feeling. I was hospitalised after I had my baby, and it took me a long time to actually be able to say, I think I'm very ill.
Yeah.
Because there's
a
bit of you going, just don't say it out loud and maybe they'll let you go home. Like, if I just... And I put up, you know, you do put up such a smoke screen. But yeah, of course, I mean, I completely understand Gemma just thinking, oh, maybe I'm tired, maybe it's okay. And they're saying, what, are you really bad? And you think, well, no, I don't feel... Oh, I did get up, didn't I? And I did make a sandwich or something. Like, you just...
But it's sometimes that quiet voice of fear, isn't it?
Yeah, it is, definitely.
That if we actually say anything, I might find out something I really don't want to find out.
And
but
I might have to go to hospital.
That could be the difference between where you live or you don't.
I know, exactly. Well, yeah, I was, again, when I got hospitalised, I was like, oh, I'm an idiot. Why didn't I say this earlier? But also, what's interesting, when I got hospitalised, I had like this sort of, you know, severe infection from after the birth. Sorry, guys, TMI. but I think I wasn't quite with it.
Yeah.
And the illness made it, like, I often, it wasn't till that, you know, when I started getting the right drugs, literally like a cloud cleared and I was like, oh, I've been really bad. And I went to Pat's with Gemma, like, as well, if you're sick, you're not quite on the right, you know, you're not quite thinking straight, are you? And sometimes when people say, are you okay? You think, I don't really know I don't know anymore.
But I can vividly remember how she looked that day and the kind of greyness in her face.
Bless her.
And that Monday's appointment was with our normal doctor, so it's been Wednesday and it's now Monday, so there's been a big decline in her health. And I think my anger with him initially was like, how have you not spotted that?
Yeah, the decline from 1 week to the next.
Have you not seen it? Even if she's not telling you.
Yeah, you should be able to look.
Surely at that point you go, you must go and get a blood test. I'm telling you now, get Simon to come and pick you up and take you to A&E, we'll get your blood tested. As it turns out, from talking to her consultant in Oxford, where we eventually ended up, it was already too late.
Yeah. I mean, that's the thing, isn't it?
That.
Yeah, like...
yeah.
That. But I understand that anger.
Yeah.
Because you just wish someone... You know, you're not a doctor, are you?
No,
so you're just
no.
like, well, I don't have the book that tells me anything. And obviously, as you said, like, they're under so much pressure.
Yeah.
They're so underfunded.
Yeah.
It's not a simple issue.
No. And so Gemma would never have wanted me vilifying him.
Yeah,
and doing all that. So I had to let go of that quite early. And
it was
good to
great.
Do it because I just thought, you know, I've got enough on my plate as it is without carrying that for the next few years.
How old was Gemma?
She turned 40. And that's the... well, there's lots of heartbreaking layers to it, but I think back, it was only in July that we had a garden party. So she was 40 in May. I mean, when I look back at it, I think, thank the Lord, she rinsed out her 40th.
She
went on a weekend with friends to Portugal. Aww. We did stuff on her actual birthday, and then we had a big... went on holiday to Portugal with all my family that Gemma had organised. And then we had a big party in July. And she, when you look back at the photos of that day, when I'm sometimes in the garden, I take my mind back to that evening in July. And it rained all morning, but the sun came out in the evening, the music, the smell of the wood-fired pizza company that came round. Just a beautiful evening, and just seeing, she was so vibrant. And her friend John from university, such a character, had bought this bizarre pink feather headdress. But she wore it all night, and she looked utterly amazing. And she just smiled throughout the whole evening. Yeah. So in terms of last birthday to go out on, she went out with a bang. But it's literally a matter of weeks before she's dead.
It's mad. We found some, so my dad was diagnosed in the February 1998 and dead by the April. And I was going through photos the other day. I don't have that many. And there's a photo of like him and my uncle and my brother. And I looked at it and I thought, well, he doesn't look like mine. He doesn't look well in that. And it was the November.
Wow.
But I can see now he looks really puffy and red. And he ran marathons and triathlons. He was training for an Ironman when he got sick.
Was he?
I mean, again, the things that
they
make you
beasts.
Go. Yeah.
Because I've done a few marathons. But the idea of running a marathon after that.
I know.
Crikey.
Yeah, he was a triathlete for like, so he's very, very fit and healthy, which apparently made it go quicker. Thanks, guys. Thanks, metabolism.
Thank you.
Thanks so much.
What a comfort.
And it was funny because, again, just looking at this picture, I thought, oh, he doesn't. You know, he was a very fit, healthy man.
Yeah.
I thought, God, he looks really ill in that picture. And it has the old date stamp on it. And I was like, oh, he was.
Yeah.
He was ill at that picture, but nobody knew, you know. Mm. It's that weird thing, like you said, about hindsight.
I mean, I've only got one picture where I think the kind of same thing, which is probably from the whenever Remembrance Sunday was in 2017. Because Ethan had been on the Cubs and they do this sort of parade through the village on Remembrance Sunday. Then they remembered the service at church.
Oh, yeah.
And we went for a meal with some friends. And actually, it's interesting, when I look back on some photos of that, only a few months ago, this is at a time when the headaches are beginning a little bit. She looks quite, she always looked very healthy. She looks quite grey in the face.
So weird, isn't it?
And you look at it thinking, was it already underway?
Was it already there?
Which it probably was.
Well, yeah, that's what I thought about then, November, because the only reason we discovered he was ill was that he went yellow in February.
Gosh.
And that was, it spread to his liver.
Yeah.
So then initially they were like, oh, it's jaundice. They're like, oh, it's liver cancer. Oh, it's pancreatic cancer.
Yeah.
So that's the only reason anybody found anything anyway.
Yeah.
But so I'm looking at him in November thinking, well, he must have probably had the tumour in the pancreas completely by then. But who, you know.
Yeah.
It's a really strange, because you think, oh, but you know someone so well, obviously. But when you're with someone day to day, those changes are very hard. Also, people have bad days. Or like they're tired and they don't look like.
Yeah, and when you've got a wife who's had insomnia for 9 years.
Well,
it's not surprising today. She's looking.
Yeah, she looks a bit tired.
You know, a bit tired.
She had a busy day. So that was the Monday. And so they didn't do any blood tests.
I get back from my counsellor.
Yeah.
And she's back in bed. I was like, what happened? I just said to rest up more, and if it's still bad, come back in a couple of days.
God.
Anyway, so, I mean, basically what happened is my mother-in-law, Gemma's mum, was so worried, and particularly when that afternoon Gemma's sick for the first time, that she felt very bad for going behind my back. But I think she was absolutely right to do so. Wendy felt I wasn't seeing things clearly enough.
Mm.
You know, I should have that Friday marched her out and said, right,
but also, if you're both saying it's fine, it's really hard when both of you are doing that agreement of like, we're not going to panic.
Yeah.
I've been in that situation where you're just like, I'm fine. I'm fine. So you think, okay, well, they're saying they're fine, so I don't want to push it.
Nope.
Like, I should respect them. Like,
see how the next few days go.
Yeah, you're trying to be practical and sensible. It's really
difficult. But she basically contacted some very close friends of ours whose sister was an eye surgeon, just felt, I wonder if Meg would speak to Gemma. So Meg spoke to Gemma that Monday night and said, based on everything I'm hearing, you really need to get away, A&E. So begrudgingly, Gemma went with her close friend Debs, because didn't really know what to do about Ethan. I thought, it could be a long night. I hope it's not, but I don't want him waking up and thinking, where are Mum and Dad? So I swapped place with Debs about midnight, and I had a feeling very early on. It was just something in the doctors' faces every time they came in. They'd done multiple blood
tests.
I just thought, there's something coming that I don't want to hear. And at about 4 o'clock, they came in and just said, we're really very sorry to say that Gemma's blood is deranged, and she's got a blood count of some sort. We don't know what yet. And then it was just a very fast sequence of events. I did go home to get Ethan ready for school because I wanted to keep it as normal as possible. Obviously, yeah. It was totally abnormal what was happening. And then went back to the hospital with Gemma's sister, Rebecca, and then get a call from Gemma as I'm travelling back to say I'm being rushed to Oxford. So she was going to be put on a machine there, a Therasys machine that basically took her blood supply out twice. So in a normal, healthy adult, your white blood cell count should be around about 10.
Mm.
Gemma's was Richtering nearly 500. So to explain it in terms of the best analogy her consultant came up with, you know when you buy like a McDonald's milkshake,
yeah.
When you first get it, it's really hard to draw it through the straw because yeah. It's in this frozen, thick state. But as it unfreezes, it thins and then it flows through the straw really quickly. The reason why she was so shattered, couldn't do anything and had the headaches is that her blood, as these white blood cells that acute mild leukemia causes to explode into your bloodstream, it turned her blood into like sludge.
Wow.
And so the heart is struggling to push it around the body. And they had to get her as quickly as possible on this machine to take out as many as they could. It knocked the white blood cell count down dramatically. That night, the chemotherapy starts. And that night, we get told it's acute mild leukemia. Never heard of it. Not a clue. I'd heard of leukemia.
Yeah, I've heard
initially,
of it.
Our thoughts were, and this is true, a lot of people now, compared to 20 years ago, get better from leukemia.
Yeah, leukemia is not one of the... Well, obviously, people do die from it. But yeah, I know what you mean in terms of ones that come with like massive alarm bells. You think, okay, I've heard people go, oh, I had leukemia and I'm okay now.
Yeah.
Like, I've heard that sentence. Yeah. Fuck, so she gets rushed to Oxford.
Yeah.
Do you then follow up to Oxford?
I was in the ambulance with her.
Oh, wow. Yeah. Jesus.
And do you know what? As I've written about this in the book, and I think this is where you understand just how much shock I was in at what was going on.
Yeah.
Because I travel that road quite a lot of times between that links sort of Reading to Oxford, and you get on the M40, and so many of my games are the Midlands and the Northwest.
Yeah.
Been up that road so many times, and here we were firing down at 85 in the middle in an ambulance with the lights going. Now, obviously, I'm scared. Of course I am. But I'm sort of chatting to the paramedic about the skills of the driver. I'm taking a video. I've still got on my phone a video.
Wow.
I did pan to Gemma. And poor old Gemma looks grey as anything. She's got an oxygen mask on. I wasn't processing what was going on in front of me. Because actually, what the hell was I doing? I thought, oh, you know, when Gemma's better, it'll be fun one day to look back on this.
Yeah.
And say, oh, look, you know, that's how bad you were. But look where you are now. But I wasn't processing at all what's
but
going on.
Shock.
Total shock.
I think it's so discounted, the shock.
Yeah.
Like, you know, I think, like I joke, I think I was in shock for about 18 years.
Yeah.
Especially being a child. Like, I I've said this before on the show, I remember my mum I think it must have been the Friday, saying he'd been in the hospital, like the cancer hospital for this week and a half or something. And on the Friday she said, you know, we're going to see Dad today. And I was like, oh, I don't want to come today. Mm. Like, I just want to stay at home. And she was like, I think you need to come today.
Yeah.
And I remember thinking, oh, let's be serious. Like, why? Okay. And I just was not computing that he was going to die.
No,
like,
no.
And my mum, bless her heart, like, she fucking knew what was going on.
Yeah.
And I remember being like, oh, okay. And even in a part of me, I remember sort of thinking, don't think about that.
Yeah.
Just get dressed. Yeah. Just go into the hospital. Like, you always go to the hospital. Oh, I have to have the horrible food. Da, 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 da. Like, the shock, you just can't, in your brain, it's like you can see it, can't you? There's a little bit going, they're about to die, and you're like, no, thank you.
Mm.
I just,
yeah.
I can't, if I look at that, I don't know if I'll be able to stand up again. I think I might just vomit and faint.
Yeah.
So I think it's such an amazing thing that your body does.
Yeah.
Like, if you had processed it, what would you have done in that ambulance? Panic, scream, Gemma might have got really distressed. So, like, your body was like, let's make it fun.
That's exactly the same thing with denial.
Yeah,
why denial
yeah.
happens, because I think it's the brain's way of saying, I'm going to suspend reality a little bit. You know deep down she's gone.
Yeah.
But if you accept this all in one go, the gravity of what's happened, it's going to floor you beyond you've been floored already.
Yeah.
It's too much. And
it's
it allowed me over those days the shock of what was happening, because part of it was being suspended. So I am videoing, thinking, what an amazing driver this woman is. She's just raw, you know. But that's the mind just saying, you cannot take all this in at once.
And what was Gemma? Did Gemma sort of think... could you sense that she thought it was very serious, or was she equally probably in the same place as you, kind of a bit shocked and like...
Ultimately, I don't know, because we never got to have those kind of conversations.
Yeah.
There's one photo I have, again, it was the ambulance, it was her being loaded up onto it. And I can see in her eyes fear.
Mm.
And why wouldn't? You know,
of course,
why wouldn't she
of course.
Be feeling fearful?
Yeah, yeah.
But I think the pace of events over that week was so relentless in terms of the treatment kicking in, that there weren't times to sit down and really think about what this meant. And because we couldn't even begin to think about what the long-term picture might be, we knew that her survival chances were going to be 50-50. Initially, that floors you, but then you go, well, listen, glass half full, glass half empty, which are we going to go for? The glass is half full. She's got 50% chance she pulls through this. I didn't know then what I know now. I didn't know any of the stats about myeloid leukemia. You know, one of the most horrifying stats is only 15% will make it beyond 5 years. So the outlook for Gemma statistically was pretty awful.
Yeah.
But we didn't look at any of that week because we just wanted to get through that week, get the chemotherapy underway, and then take it a day at a time and see where we are in a week's time, in 2 weeks' time. We knew that probably she was going to be in there through Christmas and beyond. We talked a little bit about Christmas momentarily, how we do it. We were just going day by day. I didn't leave her side. I went to get Ethan from school one night, but I was there every night. And we were just getting through each day. I've never felt as close to Gemma as I felt in those 3 days. You know, we had some amazing times together. We never talked about the possibility that she might not see Ethan grow up because we were just trusting that we'd be okay. We believed we were going to be okay because I said to the family, I don't want to hear if your friends are Googling AML, if they're reading books on AML. I don't want to know right now. We will know in time what the outlook is.
Yeah, you're not. What good would it have been to have that?
No
to
good.
Know that? Yeah.
And the fear would have intensified.
Again, it's like we said. It's like, you know, the shock and denial. Like if Gemma had 100% of the facts, well, you know, maybe she wouldn't have been able to even like have you said have a moment.
No. You've
just been like, what the? Your brain explodes.
Yeah.
So I think you know. Your brain is an amazing thing at just going, take it minute by minute, hour by hour.
Hi, this is Craig Robinson from Ways to Win, and support for this podcast comes from Invesco QQQ, the official ETF of the NCAA. Invesco QQQ is proud to sponsor this episode and even prouder to provide access to innovation for the last 25 years. Basketball has had innovations over the years, too. We're seeing the game played in new ways every day. Learn more at Invesco.com/QQQ. Let's rethink possibility. Invesco Distributors, Inc.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Hello? Fresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.
Welcome back to Griefcast with Carrie Adloyd.
So you go to Oxford on the Tuesday, she starts chemotherapy. And then what happens?
So I went back to see Gemma's consultant, Dr. Annie Pennicott, probably about 2 months later, because the speed of events of the week, but then the Thursday night, the Friday morning was so quick.
Yeah,
I didn't have a really full understanding of what had happened. So I sat down with him and sat there for 3 hours. So what had happened, and this is why, in Gemma's case, not getting treatment quick enough cost her life. It did. Not getting that blood test earlier cost her life. Yes, the outlook wasn't good. But what had happened when that blood, as I talked about, was in that very thick, sludge-like state, as it was being pushed into the brain and around the brain, the membranes that surround the cells in your brain are very, very thin. They're like sort of tissue paper. And because the blood was so thick, it perforated numerous membranes.
God.
But the blood in that thick state wouldn't flow out.
Right.
Because it was too thick to flow out these tiny
little
holes.
Like making it thinner.
So as the week went on and the chemotherapy does what it was supposed to do, starts killing off as many of the white blood cell count as it can and brings it down. Thursday night, she was on, without doubt, the best form of the week. Our friends came in to see her. There was colour black in her cheeks.
Wow.
She was actually sat on the end of the bed, and they went away saying, we're really surprised. We thought she'd be...
Yeah,
I mean, listen, we all knew it was serious, but we thought she'd be looking a lot worse.
Yeah.
But you know, when I hear back, I've put in their conversations in the book about what they said and their memories of speaking with Gemma that night. Her biggest concern was the fact she hadn't been able to have a poo for the last 3 days. And Liz says she clearly wasn't even contemplating the idea that she might not get through this.
No.
And then that night, the headaches returned for the first time since the Tuesday.
So that was the Friday night.
The Thursday night. So the headaches return. She starts becoming very disorientated. Mm. So when I took her on our now well-ingrained route from bed to loo, with me sort of holding the drip thing behind her, she's struggling to stand up straight. And it just cartwheeled over the next few hours. And then Dr. Annie Pennicott comes in early. She's being chest x-rayed in the room. She went to sleep at about 5 o'clock. I put her back to bed. My last conversation with her made no sense at all. She wasn't cogent anymore. And I just kissed her goodnight and said, look, you know, they'll sort all this out in the morning. I'm sure it's just the medication, everything. But as it turned out, she was falling unconscious because that bleeding process in the brain had begun.
Yeah.
And, you know, just hours later, I just remember following her. This is where I'm not computing at all what's going on. I'm just in this kind of continual daze as I walked behind her bed as it was taken down through the kind of maze of corridors to the big scanner, CTI scanner.
Mm.
And in she goes, comes out, back to the bedroom, back to the room, and then I get sat down with Dr. Annie Pennicott, and she's got 15 to 20 bleeds, and barring probably a miracle, there's nothing we can do. And you're then being told she's got hours. She's probably gone by 6 o'clock tonight.
She was unconscious.
She never woke up again.
Yeah.
So you're talking about last conversations with people.
Oh, well,
I know what your last conversation ever with your dad was. Mine with Gemma was an incoherent chat about trying to get her to the loo. Not really how you imagine when that horrible day comes.
I know.
Your last words are going to pan out.
We say it on the show all the time of like, there isn't such a thing as last conversation. You need to be talking before that.
Wait for the last conversation.
Do not wait. Because, and we say this so much, because even if somebody, you know, obviously it's a very extreme situation, but you know, once my dad was on the, you know, he's in the hospital, he's on a lot of morphine. Mm. He was having some real trippy conversations.
I bet he was.
Yeah. I can't remember our last proper chat when he was with it. And it's such a blur. And I remember talking to him. I remember trying to talk him about something and he wasn't with it. And I got really annoyed. Well, he's not even listening to me because, you know, you're a teenage girl and you don't understand. So, yeah, you don't ever get that, I love you, it's okay. It's not.
When our time comes or a loved one time comes, it's about them, it's about us knowing that from the people who mattered most to us, we know and we're confident that we were loved by them and are loved by them.
Yeah.
And that doesn't need a final conversation. And that's why, as you say, it's so important every day, you know, with my boy, to tell him, as I always did, but to tell him every single day, I love you and I'm proud of you and I love you endless times.
Yeah.
So that, you know, when that day sadly comes, when I'm no longer around, my boy will go, okay, I didn't have a final conversation with my dad or whatever it might be, but I know he loved me. I know.
And I talked about this different episode, but my therapist, I was getting very upset the other day that I can't remember his voice. I just can't remember it. Yeah, it's can't remember it. It's just, especially the timeline I'm on, it's just I can sort of remember, but... And then she said something really interesting to me. She was like, you can't remember his voice, but you do know what he would have said to you.
Yeah.
So she was like...
That's interesting.
She said, it's a loss, because you've lost the voice, and that is a loss, and that's sad, but you have a new thing, which is you have a voice inside you. And she said, if I say a situation to you, could you tell me, well, what would your dad say about this? Or you getting married or having a baby? And I was like, oh, yeah, I can absolutely tell you what he'd say. And she was like, well, that is his voice. That's what he's given you. You have that inside you. You just can't hear it anymore, but you actually can hear it in a different way.
I remember the Saturday after she went, I think I've heard her voice, but, you know, 36 hours ago.
Yeah.
I can't remember what Gemma sounds like. But the difference now... compared to when your dad went.
Oh, yeah, you watch a video or something.
Well, phones keep voice messages. So I remember sitting on my phone that afternoon replaying message after message.
Yeah.
And the weird thing about it, even when I occasionally do it now, it sounds so normal because, of course, it was part of normal life.
Yeah.
Gemma saying, you know, where are you, darling? I've just been nipped out to the shops. Do you want some lunch before you go to work? So normal. And yet now so utterly bizarre that that's just a voice and a memory.
It's like the voice from the past, isn't it?
Yeah.
I remember once I found his dictaphone in the office years later, and I just pressed play and just hearing...
That must have been so strange.
Oh, it was just... And I stopped immediately because I was like, what? Like, like, yes, you know, it is ghostly, it is weird. But yeah, I'm, as we talked, about this on the show, like, I'm an analog griever. Yeah. I don't have any easy access to remembering it, apart from photos, really. Yeah. That's the only thing, which in some ways is hard, but I think in other ways is a little bit helpful because I can't sit and replay something over and over again. Mm. And I wonder, I don't know, if in a way that's, well, there's no good or no bad, is it? It's just different. But I sometimes think maybe it was helpful that I wasn't able to just be like, stop, play. I could have done that with The Dictator, but it was too scary. I was just like, and we had a VHS, you know, one VHS of him at my brother's 17th birthday go-karting, you know, which actually I watched a tiny clip of the other day. Someone digitized it for me and I watched it on DVD. It was so weird. It was just so, but you know, just like you said, they just seem, they just look normal. Yeah. Like they're not walking around
there,
like,
they are.
I'm going to die, you know. So yeah, so you're in the hospital and they, so the doctor says there's a couple of hours. So did you just sit with her? Was that, what was your process then?
That was about 8 o'clock in the morning. So she went by 6:15. So it was immediately the question of what do I do regarding Ethan?
Yeah, of course.
His advice was, the age he's at, so he was 8 at the time. He's at an age where you don't need to tell him everything, but you don't want to be faced with the question in years to come, why wouldn't you allow me to see mum on her final day?
Yeah.
So I decided straight away he needs to come in. So our friend Debs, who'd been there the night before, goes to pick him up from school. I have to make the call to Gemma's mum and then Gemma's sister, who were totally unaware that this had all happened through the night.
Yeah.
You know, that they are howling down the phone at me, but they head to the hospital. And then other friends came. One of my sisters, Becky, made it from Norfolk. Hannah sadly didn't make it in time. And it was just a day of shock. Obviously, you're not really registering fully what's going on here. I just knew in my head that I had hours to rinse out every last moment with her. Mm. I knew I wasn't going to hear anything back from her. So I'm a Christian. So I tried to believe that somehow God would heal her, that he'd stop being. So I prayed for her for about 3-4 hours and then I realized, well, it's not going to happen. And I just spent the afternoon literally just recounting stories in her ear of when we met, of our marriage day, and then lots just about her relationship with Ethan and making, you know, promising her that I'll do everything to carry on the amazing work you've started in his life and the character he's already becoming because of the love and the time and the grace and the wisdom that you've already poured into him. And it was just constant, just in her ear, and I played some of her favourite songs. My friends talk about me that day and they say that you had a strength. I mean, my vicar David was there and he's been in a room sadly a few times with in a pastoral role with people who've watched a loved one die before them. And he said, I've never seen a strength like you had. So I think there was a sense of denial there, probably was, but I just knew I had to make the most of this.
That's what's so interesting about denial, of like, I think denial is always talked about very negatively, but actually sometimes it gets you through the day that your wife is dying, because it goes, okay, I'm going to just, like you said, have every moment and talk and talk. And I think that's, it sounds beautiful.
Well, if the gravity of the situation without that denial had come into play, it would have been a totally different day.
Yeah, and then how could you have been there for her?
I couldn't.
Like, she still needed you.
Yeah.
And they said, you know, I know no one quite knows, but they say that hearing is the last thing to go. And that act of love for you to just sit there and talk and promise, especially as a mother, to promise, like, I'm going to look after him. Like, what else can you do? Like, what use would it be going, well, this is awful, I'm going to accept the situation, this is fucking horrible.
Hit,
like,
the roof.
I'm going to hit the roof and punch everybody.
I mean, that all came later, but for that day.
But absolutely, it should come later. Yeah. Like, what good was it in that day? It's no good. Gemma still needed you.
And also with Ethan, when he came in.
Oh, that must have been so,
you know,
hard.
And sitting down with the doctor and him explaining in a very loving and wise way, but not disguising the gravity of what was going on. You know, I had to be calm for him.
Yeah.
And to see your 8-year-old boy weeping, you know, I had to help him through that. And then when I was able to take him into the room the 2 times he went in, I was able to be calm for him. I was able to transmit that calmness to other people and say, you really need to be calm when Ethan comes in, because this is his moment and he's scared enough as it is. He doesn't need us collectively losing the plot, even though we probably feel that's what we want to do. So he can have that last moment. And then, you know, he spends the rest of the day playing in this amazing centre called Maggie Centre just near the hospital. Families, amazing charity, look after families who've got people in hospitals with cancer and stuff. And you know, I don't think there's anything I'd change about that. Obviously, I'd change the outcome. That goes without saying. But in terms of rinsing out the time I had left with her, there's not anything I'd change about it. And I'm just really thankful that actually for those few hours, I was able to be reasonably calm.
Oh, God, yeah. Yeah, I think that's incredible. That's what, like I said, she still needed that. Ethan needed it. And, well, you know, you just, these moments that you're presented with that you had no idea you were going to be presented with, you know, you just got to get through them. And then the fallout, of course, the denial has
to crash.
Yeah, the car crash. The denial has to fall away. Yeah. And that's very painful because you are in a protected place in denial. You are in a sort of, and hospitals and hospices are slightly, you know, they're out of the world. You're in the slight bubble. Mm. And of course, then we have to get into the real life. That's fucking hard to be strong in the day-to-day, the monotony of someone not being there. I think that's when it's like, oh, fucking hell. Well, I have to do this every day.
Well, I remember only hours, well, no, probably less than 2 hours after she went, Ethan had gone back with some other friends. So they were back at the house. And, you know, this amazing group of friends and family around us sort of sorted out all Gemma's belongings. I went in to sort of hold her hand for the final time and sort of say goodbye. And then we leave and, I mean, that's when the car crash begins because I come out of the hospital and I've never shouted as loud as I shouted. All the emotion of the day, the anger at what had just happened, the anger at God that my pleas not to leave my boy without a mum had gone unheard. I just shouted my head off. I collapsed to the floor. And then we get in the car and obviously all the way back, I'm in my head thinking, how do I even begin to tell Ethan this? I can't avoid it. It has to come from me. It can't come from anyone else. I'm trying to process that and think, how do I do this? And then we hadn't eaten all day. And I, looking back, I'm surprised I was even hungry, but we were. And so the Golden Arches of McDonald's appear in the darkness on the way back from Oxford to Reading. And we stopped. And you know, exactly what you've just been then hits you less than 2 hours later, because I remember vividly walking in to that fast food restaurant. And here is everyday normal life right in front of you. The sound of kids messing around, farting around on those ruddy iPads that are stuck in McDonald's. The sound of the chip fryer crackling. Just the sights and sounds of a normal Friday night. But to me, it was an absolute affront. It was an offensive affront to hours feeling, because I was in the most bewildering, broken, horrible, frightening place I've ever been launched into. And yet here was a normal Friday night and a McDonald's. And
I
was so close
to
shout. I mean, I came within millimetres of just going, what the fuck is wrong with you? My wife has just fucking died. Mm. And you're here having your quarter pounders with cheese and your buffalo wings or whatever you're having. But of course, thankfully I didn't, because it's not their fault.
I know.
They don't know what's just happened. They don't know me. They don't know Gemma. But it was like being whacked around the head with something.
But it's your feeling inside is so strong that you just can't believe the world isn't feeling it.
No, you're
just like, but I feel this so. How are we all not crying? Why are we all not collapsing? Surely. And it's, I think affront is a really good word. You really feel like, what are you all doing smiling? Like, why is everyone... You sit the fuck down and start crying, please. And it's one of the hardest things about grief is that, you know, you're the only one in that has that feeling. Even family members have different feelings, you know, and it's... Oh, I see.
There's a line I use in the book. I just say that the thing you have to learn to accept when you go through this, however painful it is that the relentless rhythm, the drumbeat of life never stops beating, no matter who you are.
Yeah. And actually, I would say the interesting thing about grief is that that's what will save you, is that the world carries on. Mm. Like, that's actually the best thing about it. Because when you emerge from your shell, things are going on and you find yourself caught up in life, and that helps you.
Yeah.
But at the time, you're like, no, I want to stay with this person. I don't want to move forward. But actually, you know, oh, you need to do this on a Thursday and you have to pick this person up and you've got to call that person. All this life stuff helps you to start living.
And when you've got a kid,
oh God,
you haven't got a choice.
Yeah, you just got to get on with
it. Drag back. I mean, I was walking back into school a week later with Ethan.
Oh, my God.
And I remember that walk to the playground vividly, you know, from the car park to the school gates. Dreading it. And actually, most people were absolutely lovely, but there were the people who couldn't look.
Yeah.
And you're thinking, just over a week ago, I was walking in here as a husband and a dad. I'm still a dad, but I'm not a husband anymore. I've lost my wife. And here's the incessant chitter chatter of the playground. I'm not saying people were being sensitive, they weren't.
No.
But here was life again, as it has been and as it always will be. It's a school playground. the chitter chatter of daily life is echoing around your head, and yet
and what you're hearing
you
as well,
like you're on some kind of funeral march, as you walk slowly up to school.
And what you're hearing, I think, the other hard thing about it is you're hearing people who are alive.
Mm.
So that's what makes that anger come from, of like, oh, you're all here having a fine time. Nobody died in your family today, did they? Like, oh, everybody alive, are they? That's how I used to feel. All your parents here. Oh, bloody great for you, isn't it? Like, it's that sort of, because you said you don't want to compare, but there you can see these.
All your
fucking
kids have got a mum?
Yeah, yeah, exactly.
Ethan hasn't. You're totally right.
And so it does make it so hard. And then, you know, you do move through it and you do get much better at being like, I think it's so important to, like, I felt when I was a teenager, I'm very angry. I felt like, oh, I'm doing grief wrong.
Mm.
And I say on the show every fucking week, like, anger is a totally valid part of this process. Like,
it's a really important part.
Yeah, and you can do, some people just cry and they're very sad. Some people punch things and shout. And if you're in the punching and shouting club, as I am, don't feel bad about it. I mean, obviously, don't punch people, punch walls and pillows. That's what I would recommend. But it's infuriating that people just can fucking die like that. It's not, it's very anger making. And
I used to stand quite regularly in the early days down the end of our garden, and the River Thames flows well, not quite the end of our garden. There's a bit of land between our garden and the Thames. And quite regularly, because sleep was absolutely messed up in the weeks afterwards, we used to wake very, very early. And quite regularly, for those poor joggers and cyclists on the early morning towpath on the opposite side of the Thames, would have seen what would have appeared a lunatic in Wellington boots in the dressing ground, howling blue murder, a god or life or whatever. But I used to always think, look, this has got to come out somewhere. Mm-hmm. I'd rather it came out here where it's not hurting anyone. It's not worrying Ethan for a start.
Yeah,
although there were some moments, said, Daddy, were you shouting at me in the garden? Yes, I was. And some of the neighbours, I knew they were talking to each other because they didn't know what do we say to our neighbour who is quite
howling
regularly now down the end of the garden. But there was a period where I had to let. Hugely angry.
Yeah.
Hugely angry that more for my boy than anyone else.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, I felt a sense of anger that I'd been robbed of Gemma. I felt a huge amount of anger. You see, I just think there's a secondary loss to this. There's a number of losses. I've lost my wife. Ethan's lost his mum. But it's easy to forget that cancer robbed Gemma of many, many years.
Yeah.
Not just of enjoying life, but of being his mum, being hopefully enjoying still being my wife. But, you know, the average age life expectancy of a woman in the UK at the moment is about 82 years.
Yeah.
Now, we can't just assume everything would pan out, but had it done so, she wasn't even at half time.
Yeah.
So I felt a huge amount of anger that she just had her life taken away. And at a time in her life when, you know, she started this refugee project at our church. You know, now a family has come to Reading.
Wow.
They've got a house for us. So we went to the airport a few weeks ago and brought this Syrian family who had just a horrendous last few years. And they're now being supported by our church, living in this house. That's Gemma's legacy. But her life was in such an optimistic place. She was embracing being 40.
Yeah.
She was happy. And then suddenly, bang, cancer just takes her out. And that anger I felt for her, for Ethan and for myself, that has to come out.
Yeah.
And I'd rather it came out at the end of the garden in a pair of Wellington boots and a dressing gown.
Oh, my God, yeah, than in the middle of Sainsbury's.
Affecting a few joggers.
Yeah, like,
than in front of Ethan. Yeah. Or actually, some of the occasions I would get angry in front of my friends, but sod it.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
But most of the time I'd let it out somewhere it didn't impact other people too much.
My mum used to take the dog for a walk and then get a big stick and then break the stick up on a log.
I said beat the dog.
Yeah, beat the dog, sorry. And she'd kill the dog. And, you know, that's
took
what
took out squirrels and anything that moved.
No,
anything that said life, gone.
We used to have this, like, poor little poodle who was, like, so timid. And, she'd get a big stick and she'd, like, whack it on the log and, like, shout and cry in the middle of the woods. And she said the dog would just look at her like, what's she doing? And she'd, like, oh, I feel better now. And, yeah, you have to get it out. You have to get it out.
It's interesting. When I look back on nearly 18 months, looking at a kind of, I hate using the word journey, but seeing where you were, seeing where you were six months afterwards, then a year, and looking at the changes, not just in yourself, but the changes in people around you. And I think the thing I struggle with now more than anything is this whole feeling that I think it's because when people see you in a stronger place, they see the front, don't they?
Yeah.
They see you turning up at the school gate. And, you know, in the very early stages of grief, you know, all of my friends who were around me in those first few weeks, if you asked them, so Carrie, asked my friends what I was like, they'd say he was a mess. There were times where we literally didn't know how to help him anymore. I had what my counsellor described. I did have PTSD.
Mm,
I did.
Of course.
I'd watched my wife die. I had no time to prepare for it. It was a traumatic death. It's traumatic grief.
Yeah.
It's like my counsellor said, you were involved in a car crash. And it's no surprise that you were suffering from PTSD, sleep deprivation, violent mood swings. One minute you're angry, one minute you're on the floor crying, the next minute you're rash. All these kind of things were going on. And so grief, the symptoms of grief were very obvious.
Mm.
The problem, I think, for everybody who goes through this is as time goes on, time isn't a healer.
No.
That the pain, the wound that your dad's death inflicted on you will never be healed. There'll always be a big scar there.
Yeah.
But time changes things, and it changes me, it changes you.
Mm.
And so as these 18 months have gone on, I've changed. I have, to the world, become stronger.
Mm.
I smile more, I laugh more, I'm enjoying more of life than I was a year ago because the clouds have sort of parted more often and for longer. So a lot of my grief is hidden. People don't see me at home with just Ethan.
Mm.
They just think, well, he's all right now, he's in a relationship with Darina, everything's fine, and right, let's crack on. And it's like nothing ever happened.
Yeah,
you chat to good friends, you chat to colleagues, you chat to people at the school gates. And I'm not asking, I don't want people to get this wrong, I'm not asking that every time I see a friend, they're like, how are you?
How are you?
I don't want that.
No.
But sometimes I do want that. Someone just go, how you doing? How is Ethan? How is life? Just, you know, because even though I am in a relationship, you know, we don't live together.
Yeah.
Most of my days, it is just me and the boy in the house. And it's a big house and it feels ruddy, bloody empty.
Mm.
And yet now, Gemma's name isn't mentioned very often.
I know, that's why we're on this show. We mention it so much because so many people come in, they're like, oh, I haven't been able to say their name. And I'm like, Gemma existed. Gemma's a person.
And it was
Puna
you were with, wasn't it? The other
week.
Now, I found what she said interesting, that when you were both talking about this, where you almost feel embarrassed to bring their name up. Because, oh, I don't want to make you feel uncomfortable by mentioning Gemma's name, but I want to talk about my wife and about Gemma and what I miss about her and who she was and laugh about the happy times and cry about the sad, you know, what we've lost. And I think for bereaved people, when you get to this stage in the bereavement journey process, whatever you want to call it, but actually it's just getting on with life and trying to find some kind of life again, knowing that you're going to carry that burden, that pain with you for the rest of your days, is it when you get to that stage where I feel now like we are spoken to, treated like nothing ever happened.
Yeah.
Like almost Gemma never happened.
Like, yeah, that's the thing. It's like, what's hard, I think, what people don't realise, that people love a narrative.
Mm.
So they want narrative like, oh, he was very sad and now he's okay.
Yeah.
But for that to be true, Gemma has to not exist for them.
Mm.
Because if they go, he's okay, but Gemma died, so that can't be true, so I'm just not going to... It fights against a narrative in their head. And I think what's so hard when you are in grief, like somebody's died, you know, my dad died, and then when they don't mention him, you're like, it's like you're killing him again, like because then we're not even talking about him, he's not remembered. And I just find it so strange because it shouldn't... You know, I can understand a big question, you know, saying to someone like, well, how are you feeling about the concept of grief? Like, yeah, that's huge. But if you're like, oh, have you been missing Gemma lately?
Yeah.
Like, that to me is like, that's not a crazy question. That doesn't seem like impossible to ask. And what I find weird as well is like, why don't they trust us to say, oh, I'm just not really in the mood to talk about it today, but thank you for asking.
Yeah.
Because you can totally do that.
Yeah.
And I've asked people things and they've gone, oh, yeah, just, yeah, I don't really want to talk about it today, but yeah, I'm all right. But just that is like, but I tried. We tried. Now you know the door's open. You know I'm not someone who freaks out about it. It's just fear. It's all fear about emotion. People just don't want to get you upset about it.
And I think it's also because when you engage with it, I think people gravitate around you in the first 2 weeks because we just have that kind of, that instinct in us to want to help someone. But after a while, it becomes too painful a situation to stare at. My cat uses a really good line. It's like trying to stare at the sun. You can only stare at it for so long.
Oh,
and I think people get to a stage, and I do think this exists, and it's not a criticism of people, but people have compassion fatigue.
Yes.
And after a while, it's like, I can't look at this situation anymore. I can't be around you in the same way that I was. I can't feel the empathy for you in the same way that I do. It's not that I don't care and love you anymore. I still do. But I haven't got the emotional energy to keep going there with you. And actually, because we want life to be okay. We want it to be good.
We want a happy narrative.
And sadly, when something like this happens and your dad goes and Gemma goes, it interrupts life.
Mm.
And people are only prepared for it to interrupt life for so long. And the sad truth is, as you go on and it becomes a year, then 18 months, and beyond that, to go back there for your friends is interrupting life again.
Because
it's going, oh, crikey, I'm going to have to ask him about... You know, I just... A friend of mine the other week, you know... just said to me, he said, you know, you're on a much more even keel now. It wasn't a question, it was a statement.
Because he was thinking, I want that to be true.
I want that to be true.
I want that to be true.
Because then I feel comfortable and yeah. I don't have to worry about you.
I don't know. I can put you off the list of worry.
You're fine now.
You're fine. I can add someone new to the list.
In my head, I was raging.
Of course.
But I didn't say anything, I thought, because I don't want to have another sort of disagreement.
Yeah.
Yeah. You know what I think I struggle with now is that one of the difficult areas, I think, of grief is how relationships and friendships are changed by it.
Absolutely. And they fundamentally have to be, because something massive has happened. Yeah.
And I think what sometimes happens, particularly when grief is visited very suddenly on people, or it comes at the wrong time in life, and it's very hard for people to deal with, because, you know, when we did that Marie Curie event, I made the point that if we die at a ripe old age and we've had what most people would deem to be a good life, and we've ticked as many of the life boxes as we can, we know how to talk to someone who's lost that person much more because we have a reference point, because we expect it. Mm. Good innings, good life, what a great life they had. I'm so sorry, but what a great life they had. You can't say that to me as I walk back in school that morning.
No.
You cannot. What the hell do you say? Yeah. There's really very limited amount you can say. And so people did sometimes get it wrong, and I was the most broken, painful place I've ever been. So I'm going to react in irrational ways and fire off at people and sometimes put a post up on social media that was very kind of hurtful for my friends to see. I was an absolute mess. And I try and say in the book that, you know, what's really important when you're trying to support someone going through something like this, you are dealing with your friend or your sister, your brother, whoever it might be. They are the most broken they've ever been and hopefully ever will be. They've literally been snapped in two, and every single emotion is flowing out of them all at the same time in a whole variety of different ways. And it's going to be really, really uncomfortable to be around them. You're going to have to get your hands dirty. But whatever you do, don't take it personally.
Yeah.
Because this isn't about you. It's about the pain that is raging inside them that will sometimes feel like they are coming at you, that you can't get it right. As I did say to my friends, you can't understand this. You haven't lost your wife. You haven't lost your husband. Don't you even go there trying to tell me that I should be feeling this today. You do not understand. That was my common phrase. You don't understand. But of course, how can they?
Yeah, they can't.
But I think the danger is, when you're trying to support someone going through something like this, is that you do take it personally. And then you will get to that point where you go, I can't be around this anymore. And I say to people, try not, difficult though it is, not to take it personally. And if you're finding that for a time too much, step away, maybe for a couple of days, and say, I need to take myself away from this for a bit.
Because you can always come back.
You can come back.
You can come back when you're ready and you're stronger and you're in a good place.
Yeah. I just felt that there's almost undeclared gravitational pull that after a while starts to draw people away from you. And I think some of my friends found it difficult that new friends came into my life. Yeah. And it felt, I guess, to them like they were being replaced. And again, I didn't mean to come back to the book all the time, but this was a hard chapter to write, because I felt it was really important to write about why I think relationships change and trying to help people understand a bit more about how you might be able to get around someone without it totally sort of knocking you for six, so you can't be of any use to them anymore. But the reason why a handful of people became such good friends so quickly is quite simply this. What I only came to realise in months after Gemma went is that when that bomb went off on that day in November in 2017, yes, Ethan and I were at the epicentre, because our everyday life has been transformed, changed forever. And then around that with Gemma's family, my family, then my closest friends, our closest friends, that bomb blast reverberated out from that central blast point. You can't at the time see the impact that has on your family, your friends. They're all trying to support you too, because you've been hurt the most by it. You've been injured the most by it. But the reverberations of grief went out far beyond us.
Very far, very far.
And you can't see that at the time. And now I can. And that's why I think new people were able to help me in a way my friends couldn't. They were not being replaced. But what these people didn't have to deal with was coping with their own sadness and grief at losing Gemma as well as trying to support me.
Yeah.
And while they empathise hugely with losing Gemma, they could get alongside me, be in our house. That didn't make them feel uncomfortable, because they think, I remember being here with Gemma and Simon and Ethan. Now she's gone. I find it really difficult. They were none of those things. So they didn't replace. They came alongside. in the way our friends have been alongside us. And it's just...
And that will evolve again. You know, that will evolve again. Yeah. It will. It does. And those friends, you reform that relationship and you have to reform it without Gemma.
Yeah, exactly.
And that's not always a simple process. No. And that takes time and everybody kind of adjusting to that. And, you know, and then... And the ones that want to, and if you want them to, it does. They come back and they stay. And the ones that it doesn't, it's like, oh, it just wasn't meant to be for what's happened.
Yeah.
But Simon, she sounds like such a lovely, awesome woman.
Yeah,
and it's been so nice to talk about Gemma today.
Yeah.
It's been really lovely. And thank you so much.
I've loved it.
You can follow Simon on Twitter at Simon Thomas Sky and Instagram at Simon J. Thomas Sky. His book, Love Interrupted, about his grief journey, is out now. You can follow us on Twitter and Instagram at The Griefcast. The show was edited by Kate Holland with thanks to Whistledown Studios, and the music was provided by The Glue Ensemble. And remember, you are not alone.
Up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here, and it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. Hello Fresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. Hello Fresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.